Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. And tonight we're having some technical difficulties. I have to tell one of my engineers over on this side, I think we should leave that phone on so I can hear what's happening here. I'm doing this show kind of what we call in radio language, blind. What that means is that I can only hear what's coming back to us over either the internet or a telephone line. But I cannot hear anything through my my own system. There's something screwy going on. But at any rate, I will continue to do the show as best as I can. If there's some echo or some other issues, you may try to just suffer through that as best as you can. Let me, first of all, tell you tonight we're going to be talking about life in the kingdom of liberated souls. And I thought that we're getting a late start, so I'm going to have to skip our commercials. We're just going to go straight through to kind of pick up some time. And I did have an interesting commercial to go into. I'll have to deal with that next week. And we will just go on from here. So let me explain what I mean by life in the kingdom of liberated souls. There's really several classes of souls, and a human soul that is trapped in the higher mental world, which is where most humans have their souls, by the way, where virtually all of them do. Those souls are in a very, very narrow part of the higher mental world. They think in spiritual concepts that are high spiritual concepts, but they don't have a grasp of the creative methods of living in the three lower worlds. The reason they don't is because they're in such a narrow place. It's narrow not only to them, but to anyone who would be functioning from that position. And the reason for this is that a human soul has not had experience living in the three lower worlds of Earth. They may have come from another planet, even, where they lived in the three lower worlds of that planet, or they may have come from a much higher place as part of a greater being called the monad, and in that position they've never had any kind of life in a physical kind of planet, and so they're unfamiliar with the existence of this world as we have it. And our souls in general, ours being most of humanity's souls today, have some understanding of life in the physical world because they've had so many incarnates who have lived here and created some virtue, some light and form. And those that have done so have understanding of the lower three worlds, sometimes referred to as lower monastic or mental world, the astral, and, of course, the etheric physical, where we are. So they have some understanding because they've had numerous incarnates who have lived here, and those who have created some light and form, that light and form remains after their existence. It becomes part of their soul, just as they, in consciousness, become part of their soul. Nonetheless, the soul still doesn't have a great deal of ability to create in this realm because it doesn't have the senses necessary in real time that allows creation to be reasonably accurate and reasonably fulfilling, and more like God. And that's the reason we're here. We're here to do that with the senses that we take on, but those senses kind of foul us up, and they cause us to become illusioned. The soul cannot come here in total because it would become just as illusioned as we are, and that would not be a good thing for it. So it stays in this very narrow position in the higher mental world. Some people call it the second subplane, in the fourth sub part of the second subplane of the mental world. You may say, well, that's just too technical. Yeah, it is pretty technical, and it's not necessary to remember any of that. But it's a very narrow place to be. Now, a liberated soul is a soul who has gone through enough lifetimes in physical earth to create enough light in the soul itself to allow it to join together all of the mental senses in the mental world and allow it to become functioning from no less than the atomic level of the mental world. And that's usually for only one lifetime that it does that. It does something called a fusion with its solar angel in that process. It starts it anyway, it doesn't complete it. And during that fusion process, it's the very last lifetime usually that a human soul is incarnating and creating human beings. That's the last time that it does that. So it does this reunification of the mental senses between the higher and mental senses. The lower mental senses are the forms of concepts, the examples of concepts that it thinks in. And it's able to think in concepts that are huge and that are very, very creative. So those who are about to enter into that realm, usually within one or two lifetimes before they actually join all their mental senses together, and usually they're past the 90% level of unification of their mental senses, which is pretty high. Those people become amazingly creative beings. They can create things almost on a drop of a hat, and no matter what problem they're faced with, provided it is in service to others, not anything for themselves, they can almost instantly come up with amazing solutions that very few people can do. They're oftentimes considered saviors because they can help people facing nearly impossible situations to continue to use their senses in their lives or life while usually living physically, but sometimes astrally and mentally as well. They can help save those people to continue to be of service in the realms that they're living in. It's a great thing. So this is the pre-liberated soul life. This is what happens to humans in the very latest stages. There's very few of these people around. Some people call them arhats. It's a general category. There's actually very specific kinds of arhats. There's those who just begin the process, and usually they have a couple more, one or two more lifetimes before they're done with it. And they generally fall into the category of not oftentimes being able to use their creativity, even though they have it. They fail because of usually students and others that are, we'll say, working, so to speak, with them who fail to be supportive and helpful. And the results can be kind of a sabotage of the creativity of the arhat. That's one of the things that arhats suffer through. But that's the beginning. Then there's a kind of like another stage where they may enter into a point where they actually have joined 100% of their senses. Generally, the arhats at the beginning are somewhere between 90 and 97-98%. But then the next life, they might reach 100%. Even before they actually reach the mental world in the first life, they may actually reach 100% of their senses. But they still have the issue of using those senses in a monastic way and completing the operation using their lower senses, the astral and the physical together. And they have to grow those back to a place where they're closer to their mental senses, which usually requires a more cooperative group. And that usually comes in the next lifetime. Sometimes in that lifetime, they actually complete the whole process and unify all the senses in all their bodies. And then they become a member of the next kingdom, which is the kingdom of liberated souls. Sometimes some people call them masters of the ageless wisdom, etc. But in the cases that we're referring to, most of the situations are that even in the second lifetime as an arhat, some of them do not yet become masters. And they may, when they die from the physical world, or they may come back for a third lifetime, and usually that's the one that does the trick. They are able to reach 100% of their mental senses joined together, liberating their soul from the mental world, and at the same time join those senses together, liberating the entire existence of the soul to the Buddhic plane. An amazing, amazing thing. And since their alter ego, the solar angel, or this great being, which is an energy being, but as advanced and maybe considerably more so, than any of the humans involved in the situation, the Arhats. They may take another few lifetimes to start joining with that great being, but those lifetimes take place in the Buddhic world, a whole different kind of thing. So what we're really going to be talking about tonight is liberated souls who actually have made the transition from the stage of being an Arhat to living as a member of the next kingdom, a master, and we're going to be spending most of tonight's show about that. Now, some people are going to say, well, how many people, before they become masters, how many people today are, like, in that category? There's a couple of hundred people who fall into the Arhat class that are over the age of approximately 28. There's a couple hundred that are under the age of 28. And so when you add them all together, it's possible within the next decade, excluding the Arhats that die from the physical world, there may be as many as 400 Arhats in the physical world. The problem is most of them are in this first stage. And the first stage of being an Arhat, they don't succeed very well. They screw up, not because of themselves so much, but because they have they take on students who usually are the worst students for their situation. They sacrifice a great deal in order to save these people. They try to save them for future spiritual work. It's a good thing. They're doing a good thing. And so if we look at the numbers, all except a few dozen of the Arhats are in this kind of nebulous first Arhat stage, and they're not being too successful. That's kind of scary. In addition, the number of Arhats in the first stage are mostly women, not men. I know that a lot of people think of men being like the leaders, the ones that are really advanced. Not so much today. Today, most of them are actually women, especially the youngest ones, the ones below 28, the vast majority, like 80, 90% are women, okay? And then if we go into it a little deeper and we say, okay, what about the Arhats who are the really, you know, really advanced ones? They call the adept Arhats, or sometimes they just refer to them as adepts. Those great ones, they are under 21 of those, close to 21, and those are still not necessarily going to succeed, but most likely will in their life physically. And almost all, except three that I'm aware of, are also women. So there's a huge number of women that are presently functioning as Arhats, and only a few men that are functioning as Arhats. Some are more dysfunctional, but even those tend to be more the men than the women. So women are the more successful people, and therefore there's more souls incarnating as women into these new realms of, we'll say, almost becoming a member of the next kingdom. The Arhats are considered junior members of the kingdom of souls. They are actually not considered human. If you more than your 90% of your mental senses are fused together, and more than 50% of your astral and physical, you automatically, by definition of that fusion state, are considered a junior member of the next kingdom and no longer considered human, although that's kind of a weird thing because you would think they're human if you met them, so it'd be pretty strange to think of it that way. But that's how the other side, the next kingdom, considers it. Okay, that takes care of those that are entering into the next kingdom. Now let's move more quickly, if we can make up some of our time here, to those who live in the next kingdom. And what is their life like? Well, so I can really probably slow down a little bit, I think, at this point. Maybe I'm making up enough time. And that is that those who move into the next kingdom have liberated their soul, not just from the second subplane of the mental plane, but to, and not just to the atomic level of the mental plane, working with their solar angel, just in that part of the solar angel, but they have moved to working with all three parts of their solar angel, which has to do with a thing called the spiritual triadal part of the solar angel. And this great being that they're working with, that they're actually going to fuse with, they're going to join, it's like a cosmic marriage kind of thing. This great being is living simultaneously in three worlds. So three worlds are the higher mental, okay? They're living in the, and especially atomic level, it's that's as far as they go into the higher mental, and the Buddhic, and above that, the spiritual part, or atmic part, of the universe. These are very complex dimensions of time and space, and these great beings are able to have senses to sense the complexity of these dimensions all at the same time together. They are fusing these three parts of their bodies together as they fuse with the liberated soul. So they start, as they start fusing the three parts of their bodies together, they're simultaneously fusing with the master and vice versa, and this is allowing both to move on to become something even greater, which is called a liberated monad. But that's a whole other story. Okay, you might say, boy, I can't follow all this. It's okay. If you if this is like, you know, too technical, don't worry about it. Because I'm going to be telling you mostly about what life is like and not so much about all this technical stuff. I'm just covering this so that for those of you who have read about this, it'll make more sense to you. Those of you who haven't read about it, it's okay. Don't worry. Okay. So this is a wondrous situation because these beings are becoming more and more godlike, although certainly quite far from their own creator, but still creating more and more like their creator by having few senses and being able to live in multiple dimensions of time and space at the same time. When the master liberates itself to become a liberated soul and it moves to the fourth subplane of the Buddhic plane, that's where the liberated soul lives, that master can serve them in the three lower worlds, which is the mental, astral, and here in the etheric physical, all at the same time. The ability to sense through three dimensions of the seven dimensions of the universe is huge. We can barely sense through part of one dimension here in the physical universe. We really can't sense the etheric or electromagnetic part of it very well. Yet these masters can sense everything that's happening at the same time in these three parts. Once you can do that, your ability to determine what the future outcome of things is going to be is amazing. Your ability to accurately determine how to create something is amazingly greater. And your ability to be of service to others becomes profound. So we can say that a liberated soul is all of those things. Amazingly creative, godlike, amazingly of service to others, and the ability to sense at accuracy levels that is unimaginable for the typical human being to think about. That's how these beings function where we are located. They also function together in the three lower parts, which is hard for us to understand. So when they serve anywhere in the three lower worlds, their service is shared instantaneously with all other beings who live and function from the Buddhic plane and above. So all other liberated souls and all other energy beings, solar angels, that can live in the Buddhic world and above, simultaneously receive all of the sense in service that any liberated soul is experiencing. So you're not just gaining from your own individuality, which is a great thing, and your tremendous creative efforts, which is amazing, and your service to others. You're gaining through everyone else's all at the same time once you become a liberated soul. It's a whole different way of experiencing reality. Now, some people have said, well, isn't that true of an adept or an arhat in his last lifetime? From the higher mental world, doesn't he have or she have such an experience? Well, you know, yes and no. They can for one specific incident with one specific element of sense that someone above them in the Buddhic world is experiencing or has experienced. That's a great thing, and I'm not going to knock it because that's way beyond what any other human being can do. But it isn't for all things at one time, and that's a big difference. As a matter of fact, it's such a big difference that I would think that an arhat would consider a vast difference between themselves and a master of the ageless wisdom or a solar angel. They would consider there to be a tremendous difference between the two kinds of living. But nonetheless, there's still a greatness just to being at that stage. It's kind of a step in that direction. And it's a good step, by the way. Okay, so what does this mean as far as these liberated souls? I mean, they're living some kind of, we could say, widened by a major amount of reality in terms of their sense of life. When we say life in the kingdom of liberated souls, we're talking about a totally different meaning to the word life. Because their lives, this shared aspect, is so broad, is so incredible, and so amazingly, we'll say close, that it's difficult for us to perceive it and understand it because we're used to being very isolated, even lonely. And it is an experience that I can talk about it, but I don't think anybody can really say, yeah, I know what that's like. Yeah. So it's a tough one for us to fully grasp the meaning of this. Now, taking it from that vantage point, then what are these masters actually doing? And what, just for the sake of continuity, who are they working with and for as their teachers, if they are at this great level? And there's another kingdom. It's beyond the kingdom of liberated souls. It's the kingdom of what some people would call the planetary souls, or the souls who do things in a creative way that involves, at a minimum, the entire planet Earth, and sometimes multiple planets, depending upon how they've chosen to advance in their development, and sometimes dealing even with stars and how they're functioning and multiples of stars. Some of them deal mostly with the karmic side of things. They actually choose these different paths, and they're working more in those paths. It is true that a liberated soul first shows interest and somewhat commits themselves to a specific path, however they may change that. And the interesting also aspect of this is there's two relative stages to a liberated soul's development. The first is called the fifth initiation, as it's related to Earth, in which they're mostly concerned with service to some parts of humanity or some elements of kingdoms in specific ways and specific times and aspects on planet Earth. And that's where their focus lies. Then they move on to what some people call the embodiment of the sixth initiation, where these masters start taking on the responsibility of how those kingdoms and things that we're developing on Earth relate to many other planets, how they relate to our star, the sun, and the being that is creating through that body, we'll call it. And they become more focused into other hierarchy of souls in other star systems, and what they are doing and how they connect with those star systems. So in one case, you could say they're very kind of ethnocentric about Earth, which is like the fifth initiatory liberated souls. And then the sixth ones are more kind of otherworldly in a lot of their approach. They still deal with Earth, but it's more in how Earth is connecting with other places. And then when they reach the next initiation to become a complete member of the planetary kingdom. And at that point, their focus moves way away from any specifics about humans and their interactions or any specific single kingdom. They're more concerned about how all the kingdoms, all the life on Earth is working, and they're more concerned about creating life in total from a place called the spiritual plane or the Atmic plane, rather than pieces of it, as they might from the Buddhic realm. a very different and interesting way of looking at life, because their approach is, I would call it, the best way I could describe it, is more universal and wide in its vision, more godlike, definitely more godlike in the way that they see us in life. They don't ignore, and they aren't disconnected with, and do not ignore us, but they do have a greater need and understanding for the creation of light in the universe, and they don't try to just focus it through one kingdom at a time. Okay, enough said about that. So we've got a kind of, we can see where the kingdom of liberated souls fits into this whole thing. And what is life like? Well, once an adept has unified all of their senses together and has served the most they can through their solar angel without taking anything from the solar angel during a lifetime of service, during that lifetime, they are capable of choosing to move on to the next kingdom. They have to make the choice themselves. And when they do, they do so through an act of will and power together, but balanced with an equal amount of love. The balancing of the love is a very difficult problem, because you have to have, if you balance will and power, you have to have a lot more love than you have will and power in order to balance them. And if you don't do that, by the way, you can fall into evil, but arhats don't generally do that. But lower level humans do, and they go in the opposite direction. So this type of process, to some people say finish the fourth initiation and take the fifth, requires this unusual balance of a huge amount of love and compassion, as it's called, for humanity, to equal the amount of creativity and actual development and construction of improvement in sense in yourself and others, and eventually improvement in life and in the environment in yourself and others. Those have to be balanced. And the amount of compassion is the hardest thing to develop, because it requires the participation with students and others that are choosing to co-create. And so their co-creation may be just as sharp as yours, but if their compassion is low, if they become emotional, or if they fail to be as loving as they need to be in their balancing of their creativity with their power, the results can be that the limitation on the teacher or the arhat becomes extreme, much more hurtful to the teacher than to the student themselves. The student may suffer consequences for their behaviors or those assisting. Sometimes they're not always students. They may be associates in other ways, but it still counts. And so this balancing is a real difficult problem, because most of the balancing is outside of the control directly of the arhat. And the arhat cannot rely upon its alter ego, the solar angel, or some people call it the inner guide, or whatever you want to call it, this great angelic being that is helping. The arhat is attempting to not rely upon any compassion coming to the arhat or from this being to anyone else to make up for any loss that the arhat might have. Very, very difficult problem, because most people have the exact opposite. When they don't feel that others are helping them and don't feel loved, they get this sense from this great being. And when they are not loving, they get their conscience bothers them. They get assistance from this great being to help them become more loving. The arhat doesn't get that. Nothing. The arhat has to be contributing to the solar angel, not vice versa. And so this compassion problem is magnified many, many times over. And on almost every front, almost every side, the arhat has to overcome the balancing problem and reach this point of being such a creative being itself, or him, herself, or himself, and being such an amazing, capable unifier of sense and abilities, and discipline even, but giving those up many times to raise its level, his or her level of compassion, which may slow down things, may produce catastrophes at times, and other problems. But that's just the way it is. So this is the big problem. This is the big problem, and it's a challenge. And the challenge is usually met with tremendous sacrifice and great, great stamina, and sometimes the loss of a particular part of a lifetime, it's usually the physical one, because the bodies are damaged whenever there is this imbalance taking place. All right, but the liberated soul has achieved the balance. The liberated soul is now this amazing being who always is balancing its compassion, not just for humanity, by the way, but for all of the life in the kingdoms below it. That's the beginning master. All the life in the kingdoms below it is balanced in its compassion in comparison to its ability to create and to help produce more life. This is an amazing ability, because it's hard enough just to be compassionate towards humanity without trying to be now compassionate towards our life, balancing it out so it's this kind of perfection that these beings can do. The reason they're able to achieve it is because they can sense and think and create in a three lower worlds all at the same time. That's the ticket. That's what they need, and that's what they have developed for themselves as an ability, so that they can achieve this almost seemingly impossible life. And they do it all the time. In other words, 24 hours a day, all the time, these great ones are consistently doing this amazing thing. That for a human being, if they could do it once in 100 lifetimes, would be an amazing achievement. So it's a pretty remarkable state that some being can reach this state of living as this liberated soul. Now, the masters choose, therefore, to initially focus somewhat more, usually, on one of the kingdoms. That's one of the things they do. And then there's a sub-kingdom that they may also focus on called the energy sub-kingdom. And that kingdom has beings in it also, but they're made out of more energy than spirit. It's kind of a strange thing. And that includes this being we call the solar angel, although it's so advanced in its energy that its spirit is equally amazing. And it is automatically a sixth level initiate being, much higher in consciousness than a new liberated soul is. And the liberated soul has to kind of catch up with this energy being in consciousness, again, in that realm of compassion. But it can't take from the being. It can only co-create with it. It's not allowed to be taught by or take from. It's through co-creation that it raises itself up to a higher level. Absolutely remarkable stuff. Okay, so these masters spend their time working with other masters of similar interest, but not always of similar interest. And that within similar interest, they work within, some people call it an ashram, they work within a group that tends to seek to advance one of the lower kingdoms, and in some cases, some of them choose to be primarily focused on just balancing the kingdoms together, some of them about specifically advancing a kingdom, and sometimes some of them are focused on dealing with the human kingdom and evil, especially on Earth, because Earth is a unique kind of It's a unique kind of place. It has more evil on it than just about any other planet, which means it's all focused in the human kingdom, because that's where evil starts. And most masters have to deal with some of the evil in humanity, because even if they're focused on a different kingdom than humans as their main focus, we're screwing up that kingdom. So if they don't help deal with some of the evil in the human kingdom, then we got a problem. But they usually take care of it, and it's a good thing. Now, getting to this idea of, well, okay, what are they doing more specifically? It's so vast a subject that I can give you some examples, but it's a little bit daunting to try to comprehend how a master may be working. Let me give you some small examples so that we can focus in on this. Let's look at tornadoes, because they've been in the news recently. And tornadoes are an imbalance in energy in the energy kingdom caused by human selfishness. Okay. Boy, that's a tough one, I know. And everybody thinks that it's too much energy or too little energy. It's just an imbalance. Think of it as an imbalance. And tornadoes are attracted because they're controlled by this negative energy effect of imbalance to the more selfish collective humanity when they are most destructive. That's when they become most powerful, and unfortunately they move more towards populated areas where there's a lot of people living. And you could say, well, that's terrible. It is, and unfortunately this is something we endure. The next kingdom tries to, first of all, get humanity to become less selfish. That reduces things like tornadoes. And at the same time, it allows them to sometimes gently nudge the tornado away from doing its most destruction and moving most towards the thought of humans, because energy follows thought greater than its own. And many times it allows the tornado to just do its thing in an environment where only lower kingdoms are harmed, and only to a minor extent. This is a good outcome in comparison to the tornado running into a populated area of humans. But nonetheless, this is one of the areas that several masters, several of these liberated souls, may be functioning. They're generally in an area called the third ashram, third ray ashram, and their functioning is to try to alter these relatively negative effects. You can say, well, what about earthquakes? What about all those other things? Tsunamis that come from earthquakes. Same concept, a little different in the way that the methodology is used, because tornadoes have a very specific but less broad approach on life. A tsunami is much worse, much broader, generally speaking. And so would that be true to some extent with earthquakes, depending upon where they become active? There are actually more earthquakes than we realize, but most of them don't happen in populated areas. When they do, of course, they're devastating, usually, if they're of any specific size, any significant size. Now, that's an example. That's an example of a small part of one of these liberated souls' life might be paying attention to that sort of thing. And along the same master's general thought, in terms of how they choose to create, they may be concerned about how humans are presently, we'll say selfishly, creating an economy. Now, how do you create an economy in selfish ways? Well, by trying to become wealthy and gain economic advantage over others for the sake of one's selfishness. And if one is doing it for that purpose in general, that will lead to greater levels of negativity in the economy, which produces eventually economic woes. These economic woes are not necessarily just the result of, say, a certain kind of economy, like capitalistic or socialistic or whatever. It's just the outgrowth of the selfishness itself. Some economic economies produce more of this than others because they reduce freedom, and freedom is self-limiting in how dark usually the economy becomes in general. It doesn't stop a specific company or series of companies from becoming monopolistic if you're a capitalist, but it does cut down in general the darkness or selfishness overall, whereas some other systems like communism do the reverse. So the process is one of trying to help humanity become less selfish. And as we learn to be less selfish, we develop stronger economies where there is a ability for each person to generally do better than they would otherwise. It doesn't guarantee that each person, each individual, will have whatever they want. Of course, in communism, they believe it does, but that's nonsense. And it's counterproductive if people could get whatever they wanted, because they would not learn how to be unselfish. So this is an area where Master could pay some attention, even though they're dealing with tornadoes. They might also be dealing with elements of the economy, even though they're seemingly very different. They actually have to do with something called the Third Reich. And it's from that perspective that these masters are sometimes working. They work with other Reich masters, too, because there's a connection between all the Reichs and life itself. They are dealing with specific senses in life. And the Third Reich is the throat chakra. And this is expressed in a number of kinds of living things. Not all living things have a throat chakra, and not all of them depend so heavily on the throat chakra as humans do. But nonetheless, this is a big deal. And so they do specialize, we'll say, in this kind of energy and how it is affected by thought. They create as much through thought as anything else in their existence. You could say, well, if they could just think, why don't they just think to make everything perfect and we'd be fine? Well, that would never work because they have to allow virtually everything in life to be free. They can only make choices that helps to increase freedom while it allows life to prosper more and to be more abundant. But if it decreases freedom, they are self-limiting in using their thought to change anything. It's a difficult discipline to learn. And again, it's this compassion thing, balancing out the creativity. You can see how that's such a critical thing to have if you're going to be one of these great beings, because otherwise you could become a real dark one who doesn't have that compassion and just creates wantonly to destroy or to control life and to do what they want with life regardless of the outcome, and they don't care about freedom. As a matter of fact, they relish in being in control of others and others having little or no freedom. So what else do the liberated souls do? Do they have close camaraderie? Do they have friendships with others who are like themselves or even more advanced? Yes, they're closer to each other than we can even imagine, because they share their thoughts. They share their creations. They share their knowledge. And through this, they're able to be extremely close. Now, some people can claim, and it would be somewhat true, that they're not perfect beings, so they can't share everything about themselves yet. And that is a true statement. As an example, the only thoughts I can share involve knowledge that is applied to something they're serving in the three lower worlds or possibly in the Buddhic world that they exist in. That's a limitation, and I agree that is a big limitation, but it's still way beyond humans. So regardless of how much that may limit them to some extent, it's still pretty much an amazing feat for them to be able to do that. Okay, so they're extremely close with others. Now, can they live as one in mental ability? Not yet. Only at certain times, as I described. But they can sense knowledge. And so that's it. They have omniscience. They can know all of what others are co-serving in, that they are serving in. So that's the way they can be omniscient. So that's a tremendous thing, to have a level of omniscience. Tremendously capable. What else? Do they have a close bond with another of the opposite sex, as we would put it? Yes. They have husbands and wives, as we would call them, but on a different kind of marital relationship than humans think of, because their bonding is through the unifying of their senses together beyond just having close contact, which we might identify as potential sexuality in their bodies between each other. They have, and they do have that. So some people think that they're asexual. They are not asexual. But they have something way beyond that, because they share their senses. So as one feels, even if they're not in service, the other does. Even if they're not serving. That's a pretty big step from being human. And you can imagine what that is about, because it's so hard for us to understand this, but masters actually are sharing their lives together from an experiential level. Humans at advanced stages can do this as well, especially if that's what their purpose is in life, in their service. But it's a rarity, and a very big rarity, and masters live this as a natural part of their existence. So if that doesn't make you wonder about having a more meaningful life, I don't know what would, actually. That's a biggie. Now, some people have asked me at times, well, do they have offspring? Do they have children? No. The reason they can't have children is because to be a master, you have to go through the human stages. Only human beings can have children who then live out lifetimes that aren't, and these aren't incarnates of non-liberated souls. There is no such thing in a consequence with masters. What masters would call their children is people who are advanced humans, who become students of masters. These they treat as their children. Not in a pejorative sense and not in a negative way, but children in the sense that they realize that these are the ones who are going to eventually become arhats and will become junior members of their kingdom, and they will become the equivalent of what the masters are today. And so they see those advanced humans in that way, and in order to be in this, we'll say, position, a person needs to have some contact with one of these liberated souls, and that would mean that they have to be an advanced initiate. It doesn't mean they have to be an arhat, but they have to be an advanced initiate. And then they have this contact, and so now they may have had a master that they never knew about, who was technically their teacher, but really they had no direct contact with. And now once they have direct contact, then you can say they almost are in a child-parent kind of relationship, but nothing like is normal to children and parents, because the masters expect humans to be far more responsible than the typical human adult is as an adult. So but the responsibility now is about being a member of the next kingdom. And so what they're concerned about is not about the things you do as a human, unless it curtails the next thing I'm going to explain. What they're concerned about is how well you're responsible in being a liberated soul in training, and how much are you liberating your soul in that particular lifetime, how much you're building the bridge between yourself and your solar angel and your personality to your soul, doing this amazing work that leads you into the next kingdom. That's what they're concerned about. That's the biggie. And that biggie is really a fascinating and remarkable place to be in. It's so small relationship that a lot of people say, well, yeah, but, you know, isn't it true that masters really don't have much contact with humans anymore? Yes, because this relationship is so difficult for humans to grasp and to follow, to try to be responsible on a level beyond human to and with a being who is not human at all and is amazingly advanced. Very difficult position to be in. And when these liberated souls used to have contact with people who weren't so responsible and who were not at this level, they found over time it made those people more egotistical and arrogant. And it led to an increased responsibility to a decrease in responsibility over time. So it was finally decided that they, in general, would cease to have contact with human beings for the near future. And only after humans reach a point where they don't become arrogant, they don't become thinking they're special or something because they have a relationship with one of these liberated souls, it's only once they reach that point that we can say that they're safe to have some exposure with these next kingdom, the liberated souls. And also a thing that's really problematic is that some of the people who had contact with liberated souls became evil. They fell off the spiritual path completely and went in the wrong direction in the past because they were not advanced enough to have this contact, and it led to negative results. Let me give you a cooling off period. I wasn't going to do any commercials, but I will do this. I thought I'd give you just a few minutes here to let your brain cool off, because I've said an awful lot in less than an hour to make up for some of the time that we lost with our still confused communication. I don't know what we're going to do about this, but we'll work on it during the next week to make sure that we're able to function correctly with our radio station in California. All right. I wanted to let you know about a doctor who is a naturopathic medical doctor who I met just this week, and I think he's really a remarkable person, someone who you might find could be very helpful if you're having any kind of health issues. His name is Dr. Brendan McCarthy. Brendan, B-R-E-N-D-A-N, Brendan McCarthy, M-C-C-A-R-T-H-Y. And he's a very different sort of fellow. First of all the nonsense that you usually have to go through with the arrogance of doctors, etc., he's humble. That was the first thing I noticed about him. He had humility. He has a place, his own kind of center. It's called the Protea Medical Center. It's over in Chandler, which is not very far from where I'm speaking to you. And he's open 6 days a week. And you could just literally walk in there and say, hey, I need some medical assistance. I have this problem, that problem. And he caters to people who don't have insurance. His fees are low relative to anybody else I'm familiar with. He's in the Sprouts Shopping Center over on the southeast corner of Ray and Dobson, for those of you who are familiar with Chandler. And he's it's a couple stories east of Sprouts. And he's got this center that is totally, like, non-medical looking. You walk in there, and it's got, like, it's got this juice kind of bar thing, and he's got some, you know, yoga stuff going on, and even the examining rooms are minimally medical stuff. But he's still a real doctor. He can help you with most of the things that people need help with. He tends to work with people who have problems with various hormonal issues. He helps people as they're growing older with replacement therapies, trying to use more natural things that allows us to grow old in a graceful way without going through a lot of problems. He's very nutritionally oriented, so that's a good thing. He uses all kinds of herbs and is very familiar with Eastern, including Chinese, herbal medicines, which, of course, is up our line. The group that I'm a part of and myself, we're very familiar with that. And of course, we helped to create some products with it. And he's into all that stuff. So he's a good person to go to if you are too. And he helps with allergies and all kinds of other factors. He uses acupuncture and helps people with certain kinds of pain. And he has this elixir bar offering kind of kava mixtures of drinks. It's just an amazing place. You walk into it, and you think you're walking into a high-class health spa rather than to a doctor's office. And he's just a terrific guy. So if you're interested, you can go to his website. That's ProteaLife, ProteaLife.com. You can look him up there. And you can call him at 480-557-9095. He's located, the exact address is 1949 West Ray Road. Give him a call. Tell him you heard about it on this show, and I'm sure he'll be glad to hear about that. I'm working with him to have him on a segment of Why Life Is in the near future, to talk about some of the things he does and what his interests are, et cetera. And so you'll probably hear from him if you keep listening to the show, because I'm hoping to get him on in the not-too-distant future. Maybe even next week. We'll see how things work out. Okay, I'm going to just take a little zip of something right now. Take a drink. Very good. I've been talking for about an hour here straight. So let me go on now. What is life in the kingdom of liberated souls further like? Well, a liberated master is a being who is multi-creative and talented. We tend to think of these beings being along a certain ray line, but that is so limiting and so wrong. They tend to work together with others in certain projects that may be along a certain interest. That is a true statement. But you should also be aware that besides doing that, they can enter into any area of creative endeavor to help any other master, including those far and away more liberated than they are, more developed than they are, sometimes several initiations higher. And they are completely capable of being creative, as though not as good at it, possibly, as the masters that are way above them. And they many times are found to be assisting beings, masters, who are in the planetary kingdom and a couple of initiations ahead of them. So this is not unusual. As a matter of fact, it's quite common that happened. And so we can also say that they're not only multi-talented, but they're talented in the ability to be totally humble in the presence of those greater than themselves without interfering, as humans so often do, and offering all the assistance they possibly can, which may be very limited, and yet being able to do so in a way which is called spiritual hierarchical thought, where they do not interfere with others, they only contribute, and help. They're self-limiting if they find that their help is not good enough to meet the responsibilities of what is taking place. So they have these, we'll say, profound close relationships even with beings that are far more advanced than they are. And they also have it with their contemporaries. Now, in contemporary relationships, they will work in areas that they're very unfamiliar with, as we'll call it students might and do, because they want to gain a much wider perspective of the universe and of God, their creator, than just being of service in their specific expertise, you might say. And they have no problem in doing this. They are the true Renaissance beings. They are the ones that can venture and do venture into virtually every area of life at times, even though they are specifically committed to certain projects and doing certain things. They still do this sort of stuff. Even adepts and lower-level arhats have some of this in themselves. They do this sort of thing. So, you know, this is, of course, the master is far more of this nature than is the human, even than the human adept is. And so it's an amazing thing that if we examine the richness of these souls' lives, they, although they lived a very limited life to some extent while they were unliberated in part, stuck on part of the smallest part or narrow part of the middle world, the opposite is true once they get to the Buddhic plane. They become amazingly creative, amazingly informed of almost everything, and amazingly understanding of almost everything. Just a true great being, a great being of life. To be around these beings requires some fortitude if you're not yet at their level, because they are so amazingly creative and so energetic in their approach towards being of service that to stay up with them is no easy chore. They put a demand on anyone that chooses to co-serve with them at any point or time. They fully expect a high degree of responsible creation and an even higher degree of compassion. For beginning arhats, the challenge is to be compassionate enough to even not be pushed away. Because if the balance is not there in the compassion, the lack of compassion acts as a barrier to not only communication with these beings, but virtually any contact whatsoever. It's very, very difficult to understand what I'm saying, because we don't see compassion as a thing. We see it as like a feeling. And I'm not saying it in terms of a feeling. I'm talking about it as a thing. If you have the level of compassion they have, you can co-serve with them day and night. You can do whatever you need to do. If you don't, the lack of compassion produces like a barrier that pushes you away from them and makes it very difficult for them to be in contact even with you. It doesn't make it impossible because they can do whatever they choose to. It just makes it more difficult. So ultimately, those who can balance their compassion with their creation and with the actual product of that creation in terms of producing service in life, those people have amazing life because they are co-serving with beings for the next kingdom. And so that's a wonderful thing, but that's a rare thing too, because you're not going to be in that position very long, because once you start doing it within a short time, probably less than a whole lifetime, you'll become a master yourself. So that's how it works. It sort of accelerates the whole process once you get close. Now, in addition, these beings are able to, at times, experience what other worlds are like. They can sometimes, and do sometimes, share these experiences with their students. But the most important thing is that they actually can directly experience other worlds through service with the worlds. Now, this is a little hard to understand. I'll try to do the best I can. They can, if they co-serve with a planet that's in a star hundreds, even a thousand or more light years away from Earth, which seems impossible, they can share some of the scents of their contemporaries in those other worlds, and therefore they can experience life in those other worlds as though they were actually living there, even though they're an incredible time distance away from those places. That makes them universal kind of experiencing beings as they develop more and more of this. A beginning liberated soul has only minutes, maybe a week, of that kind of experience, whereas the more advanced ones may be spending the majority of each day doing that kind of activity. And the experience of life in other worlds, millions of them eventually, it makes these beings into much greater, more well-rounded, more developed in who they are. Because, I mean, Earth in itself is a pretty interesting world, but it's not all that big of life, at least, in comparison to the universe. And so they're starting to have a universal experience of God. Eventually, they will experience all life everywhere in all time. But that's not for a long time to come. So this is like the beginning of that experience. And liberated souls start almost immediately having small moments of these experiences that grow in time. They can develop very close relationships eventually, with any close service, with beings who are extremely far away, maybe even in another galaxy eventually. That's getting into a really high advanced being, way beyond just the next kingdom. And so this is a truly dramatic difference between life as a human being and life as a liberated soul. Also, when they're creating in the three lower worlds, they are able to experience the effects of their creation, not just in the kingdom that they're working most in, but they can sense the effects, depending upon how good they're at, in all the other kingdoms of life. And so they're experiencing life at a much more dynamic and broad scale right here on Earth, not to even mention getting into other planets. This broad scale is dramatic. It gives them a different perspective of what it means to be alive. Just imagine, and I'm going to try to help you do this now, because this is not easy. Okay, and you're going to think I'm crazy maybe, but I know this to be true, but you may think it's all fantasy. So just imagine that if everything you did during the day was, first of all, focused out on others and serving others, let's say some other people that are around you who needed this or that, but not only did you experience their changes in their life and how they're creating good things, which is part of a thing called bliss, but you also experience all the effects that they're having and that you're having on all the kingdoms besides their kingdom and the human kingdom. They experience that too, but the kingdom, you know, the animal kingdom, plant kingdom, even microbials, everything. They're experiencing how all of this is affecting everything all at the same time. And then eventually they experience what the past was like and what the future might be like, very likely will be like, eventually all at the same time. Just imagine what that kind of life is like. How much richer, how much more meaningful is that life than the life of being us, okay, trapped in our own bodies and minds and barely even understand what we're like, much less what any of our contemporary people are like and how much anything else is like. So you could just imagine how profound a difference that is in living that kind of lifetime. And that's the beginning of a liberated soul's experiences and how they are sensing so differently and experiencing so differently. Now, the projects. Let's talk about some of the projects that they are involved in. I don't know if project would be, it sounds like too small of a term, but I'll do the best I can. All right. They work together because they know that certain other of their kingdom, and just so you understand, we're talking about, let me be 75 of these people. That's all there are on Earth right now that are in the next, very next kingdom. There's another 30, give or take, in the next kingdom beyond them, which is like the planetary kingdom. But still, that's a very small number. So they work together with some of their associates. It could be, you know, another half dozen or more. And in it could probably is even more than that. Maybe 20, it could be 10, it could be 12. But they're working together to try to be the maximum level of responsible creative beings. And as specialists, while they're also co-serving as non-specialists with others who have their own specialty. It's kind of a strange thing. It's almost like you have this tremendously effective special group who also are generalists and work with all the other specialist groups. And as generalists, they're introducing kind of off-the-wall, oddball, unusual ways of looking at issues, whereas the specialists have more, we'll say, deep knowledge and understanding, but may not have the most open viewpoint on how to deal with the nature of some areas of opportunity for creation, which many people call problems. And on Earth, we have many of these opportunities for creation, which are really very severe problems. And so they are working to try to deal with these problems as both specialists and generalists, depending upon which group of actors they're working with in any particular time. It's a fascinating way of living your life because most people narrow their life. They expand their lives in almost every way imaginable, and they continually are operating in two different ways at the same time. The generalist, that is like the Renaissance person or man or woman, and the extreme specialist who has a greater understanding than almost other, all other forms of life about a specific thing or things that they're trying to crack a problem with or try to be of some service with. Truly amazing kinds of life. Do they have any problems with evil? We might even say enemies with evil. Yeah, they do. The dark ones, the evil beings, some of them were on the spiritual path and may have even been students at one time or another of these advanced beings, maybe when they were still human, though. And these dark ones are continually attempting to destroy life in God. And part of God is the higher kingdoms, for sure, if you haven't figured that out by now. So evil is seeking to break the hold that goodness in the higher kingdoms and souls have over life. They want to prevent souls from having an effect on life. And they do so mostly through humanity, but they nonetheless are very destructive and harmful. They know sometimes of the specific members in the other kingdom and will do whatever they can to disrupt or create a problem if there is anything they can do. Now, the interesting thing here is going to sound very strange. These souls cannot directly interfere with the freedom of dark ones except under strange and unusual conditions. The dark ones are free to do whatever they want to do, provided that they don't play with the rules of karma beyond a certain level. The rules of karma say that what a person does, even an evil person does, they eventually have to face the outcome of if it is destructive. they will have to deal with those destructive forces. Now, the way the dark ones deal with that karma when it comes back on them is they try to divert it to some lesser dark person. So they have a hierarchy of darkness. And they try to protect themselves that way. And sometimes they're very successful for a long time at doing that. But nonetheless, there is this karmic issue that they still have to allow the karma to work its way out, and they have to allow it to, they have to assign it to others in some way so that the others are going to respond in a negative way. And this is how they handle this problem. They have the option of cheating. Now, let me tell you what they can do. I don't want to get too specific about this because I'm not trying to teach you how to be an evil person. But the dark ones can choose to either accelerate karma for good people, which is wrong, or to directly attack goodness in ways in which goodness does not deserve the attack. And if they do so at a high enough level, then these spiritual hierarchy liberated souls can come in at that point and directly intervene in the bad actions that these dark ones are taking. It's a rare occurrence because the dark ones are aware that once they go into that level, it's not a good one. And the chances are that they're going to not come out too good in this situation. What they're hoping for is that those associates, those that they're trying to do bad things to, will screw up. They themselves will become selfish, argue, fight, or whatever, among themselves or with others, or do some bad things. And then they can dump all that bad stuff onto them, even possess them in some ways. And then it relieves them of the karmic responsibility, and then that prevents the liberated souls from being able to come in and do anything about it. So I hope I'm not making you confused with all this, because it's a little bit complicated to explain it all. But so there's this balance, you could say. And if the dark ones go too far with the imbalance, and if they can't find willing participants who are going to, of their own free will, do dark things, they end up getting screwed because then the liberated souls can come in and do something. But if they can find participants who will participate with them, even though they may not be pure evil, they're still doing dark things, they'll push a lot of the energy onto them, and so they get rid of some of their energy. It's like a big payoff for them, and then the liberated souls can't do anything about it. It blocks them. So it's a big problem. The solution is obviously, if you want help from God, and God, help from God comes from souls in the next kingdom, usually. There are other ways you can get help from God, from other sources. If you want to believe it, you can get help directly from God. It's rare, but you could. Anything is possible. But here's the point. If you want to get help, you got to really be being responsible. You got to really be focused out. I tell people, just never pray if you're focused on yourself, because that's a sure ticket to getting screwed in the process, and you can see how that would work from what I just described. Pray for others. Focus in service on others, and then you'll get amazing help from all kinds of sources. There are souls out there who are just itching to help us. But we've got to be responsible ourselves, or they can't help us. I hope that makes sense. So if you're praying for yourself and saying, oh, please, God, make me rich and make me happy, give me a healthy, wealthy, this and that, that's going to just go the wrong way for you. That's certainly not going to help. If you pray for somebody else and your heart's into it and you're willing to take responsibility for them, and you serve as best as you can them yourself. You can't just say, well, God, please help this person. They're really good, but I'm not going to do anything to help either. Don't expect anything or anything to come out of that, because you're not stepping up either. As a matter of fact, you may get some very bad karma from doing it. You maybe leave yourself open to the evil that's happening to the other person. If you say, oh, yeah, I hope somebody helps them, but I'm going to be out having a good time. Well, that isn't going to work. And too many people do that, and it's a very bad thing because it leads to eventually bad outcomes. Yeah. Okay, so that's the principle. That's to liberate souls are just waiting for the opportunity to perform miracles, to be of great service with the solar angels, which are part of this next kingdom. Remember, solar angels even beyond the beginning liberated soul. They're very advanced beings, and they work together. Remember, they do work together. And so they want to help. They really do. But they can't help if we're not compassionate. They can't help if you're a spiritual disciple and you're dysfunctional and you're being irresponsible. They can't help if you're just a person who thinks it's good to pray for others but not really care about doing anything yourself about their problems. They won't help that issue either. And they won't help you if you pray for yourself if what you want is selfish and just for yourself. As a matter of fact, the chances are you're going to get nothing other than more grief from praying for that. I know it's tough, and a lot of people will disagree with me. I know that. I know that this goes against the tenets of some religions. But I have to tell you the way I understand it. I'm telling you why it is that way. I'm telling you why these liberated souls really can help, unless you're doing the things that I'm suggesting. I know people are going to be dissatisfied and maybe even hurt and angry at me for this, but it's just the way it is, as far as I can explain it. And if I'm wrong, I'm wrong, but I'm just telling you what I understand about the situation. Okay, so how is it then that we get the help of liberated souls since they want to help us? I mean, for heaven's sake, here's a vast source of great beings that could be stopping a lot of the evil in the world, that could be helping to make Earth a much closer to the sacred planet, and preventing evil from most of the time, if not all the time, being functional here. So we have that option. How do we enlist it? Well, the first is you've got to be responsible. You've got to work at your abilities, not just some ability. You've got to work where you're able to, truly, in service to others. If you do that, you're going to enlist the aid of these great beings, and you will get all kinds of amazing things happening in all the people you're trying to serve and your own life. But your motive can't be to get it in your own life. But it will still happen. And that's a good thing. That's not a bad thing. So I'm hoping that you see it the way I'm trying to explain it. Okay, and then what else can we do? Well, if you're a spiritual disciple, I'm not assuming that most people who are listening to me are, but if you're a spiritual disciple and you've made that commitment in your life, then you need to make your commitment to be responsible as a student. And you may have a physical life teacher who may be another human being more advanced. And you may have, additionally, a master who you don't know is your teacher, going to be your teacher, and is your teacher in a sense. And then you do have a solar energy being who is your alter ego to your soul, which is more advanced than your soul, of course. And this being is waiting to be of assistance, but will only be of assistance when you say, we need to assist. We need to assist, not I or you, but we. It's a we thing, and that you need to see that the best will come from your selfless focusing out and not being emotionally connected to the outcomes of what you're doing, but know right from wrong, and the highest right from the worst wrong. And be able to recognize evil, a very difficult process, by the way. We can talk a bit more about that. And being able to invite these sources to assist in the service that you're willing to co-participate in. They love co-participation. No matter how much you think you can't contribute much, the more you're willing to do whatever you can do, the more you will get help from them. Promise. Try it. That's the best way. Test this theory out. See if it's working, right? Okay. But don't test it out just for intellectual curiosity, because that won't work. You have to do it with your heart really into the service, not because you just say, well, I'll just check it out to see if I'm really see if it's going to work. Now, that's not a good enough reason. That won't work either. It will backfire. Okay, how do you recognize evil? Because here's an interesting point. These liberated souls are able to instantly recognize evil. They know it just like you know, we would know being able to see a picture on the wall and know what it is. They know instantly. They can see evil much better than we can. But how is it that we can help them to not just see evil, because they can see it, but so that we see the evil well enough to be able to responsibly co-participate? Well, we have to break something called the common monastic connection, and we need to be able to function with beings who don't have any kind of emotional response. They only have love. This is so hard for us to understand that beings are non-emotional but loving. We think that beings that are non-emotional are a-emotional. They have no feelings at all, when these are the most feeling of beings, but their feelings are all about love. They show us the way to deal with evil by being fearless. They know something that we have yet to understand. We live in a world of illusion, and we find that evil to us is a huge, terrible thing that can destroy, etc. It seeks to destroy, that's true. Its ability, though, to do so is almost non-existent, provided that we are doing all the things that I've suggested, that we have compassion, but not for evil. We have compassion for humanity. Evil is considered something somewhat different from humanity. We do not have to have compassion for evil. We only need to have compassion for those that evil is trying to harm. Okay? Now you could say, oh, I thought you're supposed to love everybody. No. The love for everybody is to understand that some are on a destructive course of their own choosing, and they need to be allowed to follow through with the destruction and not be prevented from enacting destruction upon themselves, if that's what they're seeking to do, even though they think they're trying to destroy others. If we stop them from being able to destroy others, they destroy themselves much faster, which then leads them closer to God and from hurting others. And then, ultimately, we're serving them too, because they will find their soul again. Right now, they're soulless if they're evil, or if they're moving in that direction, at least. So it's sort of, I guess you could call it the tough love standpoint. Maybe that's a little too human in its explanation. So we need to have compassion for humanity, but not necessarily for evil ones. You could say, well, what about an evil one who wants to change their ways? Can we have compassion for them? Yes, while they're trying to change their ways, we can. But while they're trying to be destructive to others, no. It's a hard thing for us to learn. It's also hard for us to not be afraid. Why are we so afraid of evil? Well, because it's a puffy thing. Evil tries to convince us it's powerful when it's very weak. It attempts to do atrocities to those that are caught in its web, to convince those who are not caught in its web that it's this powerful, great being who can do almost anything and we can't do anything too. That's a bunch of nonsense. Because while we sometimes may not be able to affect evil directly because it has certain powers that we can't use at this time, we can ask for, when we're functioning properly, the help of liberated souls and solar angels, and then we will get it, and then their power becomes totally useless against these greater beings, and they, like a shield on us, will protect us. But we only gain this protection when we're functioning responsibly and not emotionally and dealing with ourselves and our co-workers and those behind the scenes, our souls, in ways in which we are respectful and loving, and at the same time, creative and life-producing, and using our powers in ways that are for the growth of God, for the growth of life. Then we've got it made. If you can do that, you will be victorious over evil. You just have to make sure you're doing that. And it's not easy to do. I know it, because people fail in it all the time. If you do it, be careful, because once you've gotten the attention of evil, if you can't be responsible, evil's going to make your life very, very bad. And until you are responsible, you're going to learn a terrible lesson about it. So this is the point I'm trying to make. The options are there. The kingdom of souls, liberated souls, is there to be of assistance, and they want to be. They want to be. Okay, enough of this subject. Let me move on. Liberated souls are looking towards a future in which they can be more and more a part of their Creator, of God. They know that they are a piece of God, growing more of God, and their piece is fully conscious or mostly conscious of the ways that God is growing as they grow it. Humans are not. The major difference between the two kingdoms is exactly that point. Let me try to say it again to you so that you understand it better if you didn't understand the first time. Those that are liberated souls are not just trying to become more of God, because humans may sometimes do that too. They're doing it very consistently and nearly all the time. But the most important thing is that when they're doing it, they're conscious of all the effects that they're having and all the parts of life that is growing God. And they are conscious of God while God is conscious of them simultaneously. That's the difference. Humans are not conscious of God most of the time. And they are conscious of how they're growing God. And they are conscious of how they're retarding God's growth. And they are conscious of how God is conscious of them. Those missing elements in humans is because humans have not joined the two spiritual senses and the three bodies they have to the other senses. Those spiritual senses give them a sense of understanding and how to co-create with God, but unless until they join them together into a super sense, they can't sense it the way I just said, the way a soul senses. And so that missing part is so important that they're kind of lost. They're lost in illusion because they don't know what God is in comparison to what God isn't. It's why they are convinced that evil is more powerful than them. It's why they don't see evil half the time or most of the time. It's for so many other reasons that they are just gullible and confused and messed up because they are missing this grand, tremendous ability that liberated souls have. Now, liberated souls, as they develop this relationship with God, have a unique sense of who they are. That sense is that, unlike humans who are just trying to become their souls, the soul is now trying to become a thing called a monad, which is also trying to become part of God. And they take on some of the monadic or one qualities of being one with God. And this oneness between themselves and their Creator becomes so deep that eventually they start sharing in God's life. Now, that sounds very strange, and I'll try to be as clear as I can. Let me take one more drink of this liquid here. Very good. Now, that's their primary relishing aspect of life. Nothing is more blissful. It's way beyond bliss. Nothing is more unbelievably meaningful to a being than to be sharing the life of that being's creator. And the way that they share God's life is that masters who are liberated souls that are fifth and sixth level initiates share the past parts of God's life, which we call the knowledge parts, through a state of omniscience, which becomes total omniscience with God. Then, when they move to the next level of initiation, which is called the seventh, on earth, and the eighth, eventually, they start sharing God as it is growing, not only as it has grown in the past up to that point, but as it is happening at the immediate moment. And
we
each moment becomes this unbelievable growth of God for multitudes of worlds. Remember, they're starting to experience other worlds. Multitudes of worlds all at the same time. And it's just an absolutely ecstatic kind of experience. So you get the past coming together with the present, which is a state of complete love with all life that is growing from, with and from God. Amazing thing. Finally, in the last level of initiation, some people refer to it as the ninth, as it affects Earth, these beings, these liberated souls, become great monads that are liberated, and they experience God as the past, the present, and God into the future. Now, you might say, well, what do you mean God into the future? Because they can extrapolate from their position in the present, as God is growing in each present moment, all the potential future things from that moment forward. Now you can say, but eventually aren't they going to run out of present moments, because eventually they're going to reach where they reach all the moments towards the end of existence before existence has been completed, so you have a paradox called the temporal paradox. Yes, that's all true, but they experience a virtual reality till the end of this universe that they go through, and that meaning, that experience of life to them is the experience of being God, at least from their perspective. An amazing one. Without having to actually be God, at least at this time, they have experienced the God of our universe in at least one way, through their own existence. An amazing experience by far. And at that point, leave this universe. They'll come back to what this universe was about in another time, in another place. It's too far into the story to be able to explain it any further. But this is their experience, and this is what the liberated soul is looking towards. And that liberated soul is conscious that that's where it's headed to. Even at the fifth initiation, even at the very beginning of being liberated, the liberated soul actually has what I'm explaining to you as its beginning experience a little bit. And it knows where it's headed to. Unbelievable. Talk about a meaningful life. How can there be a more meaningful life? Well, actually, there are, but you get into other universes and grander things. But right now, this is an amazing level. And this is what we are all headed for. Human beings, all human beings, even the evil ones, will eventually rejoin with their souls, but most human beings aren't going to become evil, and they are all going to become liberated souls someday. And we are all headed for this life that I have, in a very cursory way, and forgive me if I didn't have enough time to explain the details of so many things I left out, but this is what we are headed for. This is the great, great future that is our promise. To be one with our Creator eventually, and to be one with all other forms of life for so long a period of time, it's incredible. And this is what life is truly going to be for us. I hope this has made some sense to you, if it hasn't confused you all. Yes, I know there's so many more examples I could have brought in. But, you know, I wanted to have a broad enough picture so that at least there's a foundation for maybe someday going into some more specifics about some of these other things I know about. And unfortunately, I have a caller right now, but you know what? We are out of time, so I'll invite that caller to call back maybe next week when I can take the call, because I don't have any way of hearing that caller or doing anything with that caller right now. So please, caller, you can email me or you can call me another time. Email will be wonderful. Set up a time. I'll talk with you both on the air or off, and we'll talk some more about this. But anyway, we're out of time for right now, and until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.